Dave.
Yes.
How are you, buddy?
I'm great, Ken. How are you?
Good, pal. Nice to have you here.
Well, it's good to hear your voice after these many emails.
Indeed, and I'm a real fan of what you are doing. Well, actually, you have a very extraordinary history.
Check the test.
In relation to sports.
Yes.
And you were somebody that, for those listening and are not familiar with your history, you really sort of came of age in the 60s and
right.
while being an award-winning player for the St. Louis Cardinals.
Correct, right.
1963
right.
to
1969. Right.
And that was a period where sports was sort of one of the last places you might expect political consciousness to,
right.
to
right.
arise. But there were indeed some, and it was an extraordinary period.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of were developing your own social conscience. At the same time, you're exploring the metanormal capacity of sports and sport consciousness.
Yeah, well, in my mind, it all kind of was coming as what I call a wavefront. It was all more or less happening at the same time. But
right.
Probably for me, started earlier, with the civil rights movement and
right.
Then with the anti-Vietnam War movement, which I was involved with, and then probably in the latter part of my career getting turned on to more, quote, spiritual matters. And I never really saw a contradiction between the two,
right.
but a lot of people that I was associated with and seemed to me on both sides of the fence did see a contradiction.
Right. And that contradiction came a little bit to the forefront when you started speaking out against the war, when a majority of Americans at that time were against it,
right.
and you were getting petitions. You had founded the Athletes Against War and got
right.
got a petition going to send to the president.
Well, we did, yeah. We had actually, we had 37 players, active players, my teammates on the Cardinals, sign a petition.
Right.
Calling for the immediate withdrawal of troops from Vietnam. And we sent that off to our legislators, our congresspeople and senators and so on. And but I think it was, a situation where athletes were young people too. And as you said, the majority of the country was opposed to the war.
Right.
And once you kind of stepped out of that bag of asking players what they felt and gave them an opportunity to express how they felt, they, like many Americans, expressed themselves and said they were against the war. So,
right.
but I think the idea of what sport was has always been what I call kind of a last bastion of a certain kind of conservatism. And and clearly this was really not the case when you really talk to the athletes and see, and ask them how they felt about it.
Yeah, exactly. And sports becoming in some ways kind of a totemistic representation of the nation.
Good point. Yeah, it's a good point.
That was certainly one of your points.
Yes.
That what were we doing with football here? And
right.
it was, in a sense, being used in a jingoistic way to prop up America's imperialism.
Well, yeah, as people would remember the halftime shows at the time, where they were
right.
pretty over the top. Lots of jet fighters flying over over the stadiums. And stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And yet, at the same time, what's going on is something that's little recognized, although it began to be recognized in the 60s and 70s with the Human Potential Movement
right.
and with books, Mike Murphy's Golf in the Kingdom.
Yes, Leonard's, that was a kickoff, sure.
Yeah, George Lenner's Ultimate Athlete, the White's book On the Zone. What also is going on is in certain sports activities, particularly at the real leading edge, there is an undeniable transcendental awareness, a transpersonal
yes.
awareness, a non-dual awareness that comes into play. And how that fits in with the world around it has been sort of one of your enduring concerns.
Yes, it has been, and it's always been a real contradiction, because I think that when those of us who started looking at this or having these experiences, I think it started with me when I was playing, having these experiences, and the kind of catchphrase, as people talk about it, is playing in the zone or
right.
playing out of your mind,
right.
is that, certain things happen when you're, maybe the best way to put it, when you're totally in the moment or you're right there.
Right.
things start to happen, which, time slows down and the speed of the game slows down.
Right.
Precognitive things begin to happen. You kind of anticipate.
Right.
But there really isn't the context, and there certainly wasn't then, and not so much even now, to kind of put these, as Mike Murphy would call them, these extraordinary kind of metanormal experiences
right.
into any kind of context that, athletes can relate to or people can relate to. And
right.
Which means we're kind of still, as you say, into more or less this totemic idea of what sport is, and it's just this measurable thing, and it's winning. And
right.
But what's forgotten is really, or not forgotten, is ignored, is subjectively speaking, what's really going on with the athlete.
Right. And one of the things that I want to talk about, we have, through email, you sent a kind of a bullet point list of topics.
That's right.
And we're going to go over all of them, because they're all really great.
We'll be here for a day.
So be it.
Okay.
I can't help but see this just in the context of your own life unfolding, because on the one hand, you do have this structure of athletics that is set up, and certainly was in the 60s, set up in this sort of totemistic, jingoistic way to, in a sense, support certain political issues.
Yeah, and I think, Ken, to interrupt you a bit, it is also specific to the sport. I think that if you analyze football a bit, which is one of my kind of stock speeches, it really is almost a war game. It's a game that's based on violence, and it's a game in the conquering and defense of territory.
Right.
And it's a game that evolved out of soccer and rugby and became a uniquely American game.
Yeah.
That was so violent that by 1907, 17 college players were killed playing college football.
Right.
In fact, Teddy Roosevelt, the president at the time, threatened to outlaw the sport because it was so violent, and it came into this country in kind of this social Darwinistic view, root hog or die, survival of the fittest.
Right.
And where it was being played, they were taking it seriously. It wasn't beyond a game. It was this struggle for life, if you will.
Right.
And so when I think when you start looking at different forms of sport, the story's a little bit different. I was just looking at some old Steve Prefontaine tapes, and here was a guy who was extraordinary runner and pushing limits, but really saw his running as an art form, as a full expression of himself, transcending competition, but realizing that competition was one of the drivers to push him.
Right.
So it depends a little bit on what sport you're talking about. And the sport I played was pretty much more the militarist, kind of totemic, as you say, American game.
Right. And at the same time, what is sort of so noticeable is the development of your own conscience, your own social conscience, in addition to having these transcendental, being in the flow, being in non-dual flow states.
Right.
How those push up against the structures that they find around them.
Right.
And
right.
In the 60s, it was, and it's still, how does, basically the question is, how does a sport, how can it be a personal transcendence? And then how does that transcendence work for social transcendence?
Mm-hmm.
And this is what you do, founding member of Athletes United for Peace, for example,
right,
is using positive aspects of sport, which can be a self-transcendence, to transcend other boundaries.
Correct.
Transcend boundaries between race, transcend boundaries between sexes, transcend any of these sort of political and social boundaries set up that ultimately divide people.
Right.
And that sports is probably the single most widely practiced avenue for transcendence, and yet it's the single least discussed
exactly. And
developed as a
form. Very good point, Ken. Yeah, that's absolutely true. Yeah.
And that's what I see as sort of the two clashing motives or structures in your life.
Well, it's in my life, and it's also what sport is. As I said before, when you take the American game, which is football, we're the only country in the world that plays it.
Right.
And some questions asked is, what is it reflecting about the culture? What are the dominant values that it reflects? The game itself, the process of the game. And those are some some interesting questions, but they are on one side of the contradiction, and certainly. The Lombardian notion that, winning is the only thing,
right,
and meaning the objective measure of winning, really says nothing about the other aspects, the that transcend that idea, the coming to bringing together of people, the experience that the athlete has him or herself as an athlete, as doing it,
right,
as an artist, if you will. So I think that, you know, that contradiction, I think, is worldwide. I don't think it's indigenous to us necessarily, because I think all societies have used the athlete, their athletes, as indications of their way of life and
sure,
values,
of course,
and so on and so forth. Certainly the Soviets did it. We do it.
Right.
And so this is really nothing new, and it kind of does mobilize people's energy. Now the Kenyans, of course, being the great runners that they are, you know, pushing that line, and the Ethiopians prior to them, and so on.
Right.
So.
Yes, and certainly didn't mean to imply that it was isolated here, just that you really became sensitive to these issues.
Right.
Really, almost right at the beginning of your career. And then watching how your life has played out, aware of both sides of this street, aware of the sort of self-contradiction that's in sports, which is that at the heart.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And it is. I think it exists for every athlete. And I think this is what I was trying to point out in my book and, you know, subsequent things that I did, and really kind of underpinned my work with the NFL Players Association and really talked about, you know, where's the athlete in this equation. And when you start looking at, you know, the, if you will, the power relationships, you see that the athlete at one point really had zero power. You're just here to play, and we'll run the whole operation. You have nothing to say about it.
Right.
To moving the players into a position where they have something to say about how their art, if you will, their athletic craft, is expressed. And that, to me, is part of the struggle of consciousness, if you will.
Well, and you, well, again, some True. Background information for people not aware, you continued to play the game and through 1969,
right,
and then through some various issues that we can discuss, in part because you were politically and socially motivated and became kind of known for that,
right,
you were being benched at that time, and you
right.
decided to...
No anti-war activity
yeah,
here.
Yeah, exactly. So you quit right. and wrote an extraordinary book that you just mentioned called Out of Their League, and it's a documentation. It was a bestseller. It was highly reviewed, critically highly praised.
Thank you. Yeah.
But it was also shocking. It was a devastating account of just the inside terror that it is the game of football, and the violence that's inculcated in the ways that these structures are
actually... It's a violent game, yeah.
Yeah, it is. And just to the extent that men are sort of willing to literally give their lives in order to win.
Right.
And that's built into that game. In a certain sense, it's built into all competitive athletics, but it sort of comes to a height in this game called football.
Right.
And Out of Their League was had an extraordinary effect. You went on in your career to basically, in terms of representing the players, you were a co-founder and for a long time the Western director of the NFL Players Association.
Correct, that's right.
And this is a union that was in large measure responsible for getting the players together, getting them to have a unified voice, and to stand up against the owners.
Right.
And so it was actually kind of a social conscience, again, getting put into the employment procedure at NFL.
Yes.
And then from there, you have extended the experience of sport into just what we were talking about earlier, which is not only is it a form of personal transcendence, it is or ought to be a form of social transcendence, of social
exactly.
justice.
That's
and so you founded, co-founded the Esalen Sports Center, and of course that's with our good friend Mike Murphy and
right.
Esalen,
right.
and that was done in 1971, and so that was right at the peak of when interest in the human potential movement and sports was starting to come online.
Right, and that was what we were trying to do, is to move those ideas, that perception, that you know, bigger view of the world, if you will, and bigger view of human beings
right.
into the realm of athletics. And Mike Murphy and George Leonard were two key guys in doing that, because, of course, Mike wrote Golf in the Kingdom,
right.
and George Leonard wrote a book called The Ultimate Athlete. So
right.
they had a lot to do with putting sport in the context of human growth and transformation.
Right.
One of the interesting things, when I as a matter of fact, when I was playing, I did go to Esalen in the off season that year, and I was struck by the fact that there was nothing to do with sport or body movement or anything. It was all kind of, you know, if you will, in your head, so to speak,
right,
in your emotions. But there was certainly a short shrift in terms of anything talking about sport or athletics. And part of the mission was, a few years later, at least on my part, was to kind of bring sports into all this, too.
Right. And that's what you say in the email, a deeper love or interest, even before I'd started working with the NFLPA.
Players Association, right.
Right. Rested on the broad question of where did sport and the athletic experience fit in with the spiritual life and practice, consciousness,
right,
human growth to consciousness, optimal performance, and so on.
Right.
All the things that were going on at Esalen in the early 1970s.
Right.
This question led me to help put together Esalen Sports Center with Mike and Dulcie Murphy, George Leonard, Bob Kegel, and Mike Spino. As you know, Murphy's Golf in the Kingdom and Leonard's The Ultimate Athlete were published during that time. Those books and Mike and Rhea White's The Zone and Mike's treatment of sport in Future of the Body pointed to a, quote, larger, more extraordinary, unquote, aspect of sport than is typically conceptually entertained.
Right.
And that's exactly right, and that's one of the things that I've also discussed with Sean Phillips, who's the...
Yes, I did listen to that interview, actually, yes.
Yeah, and it...
His FIT program is...
It's focused intensity training.
Exactly.
And he's bringing a spiritual awareness into weightlifting. And again, one of the things that I find sort of interesting is that when you mention spiritual consciousness and then you mention sports, most people get kind of a quizzical look in their eyes because
it doesn't
sports is the first place to go for spiritual.
Exactly.
But there are two different things that we're talking about here, and I think it's a concept that I'll briefly introduce because I think it has an enormous amount to do with what you're talking about, and that is the difference between structures of consciousness and states of consciousness.
Right.
And structures of consciousness are basically the mental apparatus that we use to make sense of our world, to interpret it.
Right.
And it's a various series of stages that are essentially cross-cultural and universal and have been tested in numerous cultures, and the essential deep structures are the same. And there are any number of different ways to test for this because human beings have multiple intelligences.
Right.
And these multiple intelligences develop somewhat independently of each other, and they have things like cognitive intelligence and moral intelligence and intrapersonal or introspective intelligence and interpersonal or emotional intelligence. There's an aesthetic intelligence. There's a kinesthetic intelligence. There's a musical intelligence, mathematical. But all of them, all of these multiple intelligences go through essentially the same levels of consciousness.
Would you say there's an athletic intelligence?
Depending on what you mean by athletic, because
right, okay,
athletic is kind of a combination of a couple of different intelligences.
That's true.
And so what you have is these general levels start out with a kind of an egocentric, power-driven, me-only, first-person perspective, and it's when development just can't take the role of other yet, so there is no
right,
second person or third person. And it generally has a magical view of the world because the self can do everything. The self is the center of power, and it's
right,
omniscience of the word, magic, and so on.
Right.
And then you get to a second major stage, which is a real conformist, and it's kind of the opposite of the egocentric previous stage, and one of its jobs is to curtail the impulsiveness of the previous stage.
Well, this is teamwork.
This is where you get
the idea of team.
Exactly, yeah. And it tends to be kind of very conformist and very
right,
fundamentalist and
exactly,
very absolutistic in its thinking. And then there's a move into a development of taking the third person. The previous one can take a second person, and so you have egocentric going to ethnocentric, and the third major stage is world-centric.
Right.
And that's you judge people regardless of race, color, sex, or creed. And it tends to be scientific and sort of business-oriented and, you know, just the facts. And so it falls into kind of a scientific materialism for its underside. And then there's one that actually takes a perspective on universal science and decides that there isn't just one universal story. There are many stories. There are multicultural stories.
Right.
And so you get a sensitivity stage, and a stage is postmodern, a stage is pluralistic in its values. And it is very sensitive to different value systems and basically is very sensitive not to marginalize individuals, not to
right,
judge them or rank them, but it does leave the world in a kind of a fragmented mess.
Yes, and you've been had a critique about that.
Exactly, and we have, because what all of the developmental stages have is there's a stage beyond that that starts to discover common patterns
right.
between humans. And those common patterns are integral or integrative
right.
and start to pull together the pieces that the pluralistic worldview left. And so those are the structure components. Those are what we will interpret any experience we have according to the general altitude that we're at. Now, that includes states of consciousness. And states of consciousness include meditative and contemplative states of consciousness. And these go generally, the great traditions mention four or five major natural states of consciousness.
Right.
That's waking, and then there's a dream state or subtle visionary state, and there's a deep formless state, deep dreamless state. And then there's a witness of all of that, the pure self or the true self or the
right.
witness. And then there's a non-dual state where the witness becomes one with everything that it witnesses. And these are sometimes called gross, subtle, causal and non-dual,
non-dual
states. Now, what happens when you get in the flow or you get in the zone is it's a non-dual state. But that can happen at any of those vertical structures.
Right.
So what often happens in sports is that there is indeed kind of a teamwork ethic, but underneath that, at an altitude we call red, which is the egocentric first-person stage, a lot of athletes are operating from that. That's the competitive stage. That's I want to kill you stage. That's I'm going to do better than everything stage.
Sure.
And that structure is what the non-dual state gets experienced through.
Right. So through that particular lens, then.
Exactly.
Yes, right.
And so that's how you get this sort of contradictory stance that athletics often is, which is, on the one hand, measuring states, it has very high because it's an actual experience of non-dual reality, which is a very, very profound.
Yeah, that's a very good insight. Yes.
Yeah, realization. And yet then it comes out and it tends to get interpreted according to this red altitude or egocentric altitude, and that's where a fair number of players are. They're attracted to that particular level of performance.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, which underpins sport a lot. I mean, sport
well, exactly.
is competitive. You know, it is the context. You know?
Exactly. So one of the things we want to look at here as we go through your bullet points is thinking about it in terms of which state of consciousness is being evoked and how it's being evoked and whether it's being correctly recognized and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And then the vertical structure or structure stage, the vertical stage that it's at, and then it's going to tend to get interpreted through. And you do have athletes that go all the way up into modern and postmodern, all the way up into third person and fourth person, all the way up into
mm-hmm.
universalist and pluralistic.
And well, a lot do, and I think that if, mm-hmm. and tell me if I'm interpreting this, correctly, you'll see, a lot of guys on a team that they will, although it may cost them their job, they will help another athlete become better at what.
Well, exactly.
You know? And so that always to me was that kind of selflessness about it. And you could say, well, that's because of they want to make the team better, but that's a larger perspective, if you will, or a higher perspective,
right.
as you're saying, than simply, no, I'm not going to tell them. I'm going to, keep it to myself. And
exactly. Oh, I agree entirely. And it can express both that working for the team, but it also can express all the way up to postmodern, pluralistic,
mm-hmm.
and even higher. And that's, I think, what, in part, Steve Prefontaine was doing
right.
when he was using it as an expression of his own self, not as a, in other words, as a self-actualization drive.
Yes, that.
And not as a conformist drive or a self-competitive drive, or a competitive drive per se. And in a sense, that's what the highest in sports can help people develop through these vertical structures. And that's one of the things we learn from meditation practice, and one of the things that I want to bring up here is that it's very hard to get adults to move through these vertical structure stages.
Mm-hmm.
By the time they're in their mid-20s, they tend to settle in to
right.
one major structure. They tend to be fundamentalist and
right.
very...
Hey, we got a few of those running around.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or they're modern, orange,
right.
scientific kind of excellence and meritocracy is part of the game there. Or they settle into postmodern, pluralistic, cultural, creative, and that winning is anathema on that. And so sports
well,
looked at.
Let me ask you a question. And I,
yeah.
Listening to you, and I've read some of your, structure state, and
right.
I must say I probably haven't, fully understood it. But it seemed to me, as I was saying at the outset, is that the kind of more conscious you get, if you will, the more ethical you become, or at least that's
exactly.
been my own personal equation.
Exactly.
And what you seem to be saying is it's fairly discreet to the extent that I can be a total in a non-dual state, but at a pretty lower level of
right.
of structural development.
Right. Right.
And I guess the question is, or statement question is in my experience, it has seemed to me the experiencing more the witness state or the non-dual state or moving into these more spiritual spaces, there has been an ethical component that has kind of followed
right.
along with it or been
right.
part of it.
Right. And I think that's exactly right. And that's the point that I'm making in terms of meditation studies, is that even though it's very hard to get adults to move vertically through these structures, what we found is that those who meditate actually do move, and sometimes
yes,
an average
yes.
of two stages,
absolutely.
Which is unheard of.
Right,
and
right.
my hypothesis is that basically whenever you have these altered states of consciousness that are beyond you know, your interpretive capacity at the moment, it acts, it leaves stretch marks on your mind. It acts
yes.
as a transformative.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah, right, exactly.
And so in sports, we see sort of two major moments of transformation. One is when kids come in very red and very individualistic and work and end up moving from red to amber or from egocentric to ethnocentric or from personal power to team power.
Right.
And that's one of the real you know, sort of important transformations that sports is mostly working with. But there's also ones where there's leading edge where individuals are in sports at orange or green, at modern
mm-hmm.
and postmodern.
Mm-hmm.
And the more they experience these personal transcendental states of flow or the witness, as you're saying, the more that acts to help them move up in
right.
terms of the number of
well,
perspectives they
can. And I think that, yeah, and not to jump ahead, I mean, we can hopefully jump around here, but
yeah, sure.
if you're looking at, you know, how sport is trained, and I know you're a weightlifter, and
right.
and you know, you go to the gym and there's the context and this is it, or if you're working with somebody to teach you how to, say, do weight training or
right.
or any of the components, typically that doesn't happen in terms of, okay, Ken, now either I want you to get in the moment when you're listening or go into a witness state and really observe what's going on. And in my view, the things that you can learn in a meditative context,
yes,
you can also learn in a athletic or training context.
Yes.
And that's as much of a question to you as it is an observation on my part.
Well, I think the way that it's set up now...
Not identical, but at least there's some similarities there that can...
Yes, and I think there is. And I think that there is a component of state training that happens with virtually any intense training.
Right.
And as you point out, it's... Well, to read one of your bullet points, the best measurable performance and subjective experience in sport flows from being mindful, being in
right.
the present.
Exactly.
In the state of being fully present to the experience, athletes enter the flow or the zone. In this state, extraordinary performance happens, and often times normal reality is transcended, time slows down, perception is dramatically altered, precognition occurs. And you point out Dan Millman's film, Peaceful Warrior, and Miracle Zen and the Art of Archery honed in on this.
Right.
And that's, I think, that component of state training does occur with any of these intense types of training practices.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly what happens is there's a sanction for red interpretation of this as a sanction for just, it's my power.
Yeah, and that's the context, and that's what we're talking about.
Exactly.
The context needs to be expanded.
Exactly. And that's what I see your life doing so much of,
right.
is if I, you know, forgive me for sort of pigeonholing you here.
Go
but,
ahead.
but
you
coming,
can too.
but coming in as a, you know, an orange or green right out of college, and being really socially concerned shows a really green attempt to deal with this. And then I think as within a decade, you are at integral, you are at second tier or integral stages of development, and looking at how these things could be pulled together,
mm-hmm.
how the experience you're having in sports, this experience of personal transcendence, can become a social transcendence
right,
and, a,
right.
and a drive for social justice
right.
and peace. And so I see that, you know, so your whole life is part of the contradictions that you were dealing with in the world out there is also the difficulties that we have in terms of states and structures in our own being.
Mm-hmm.
And having these states actually drive a structural development.
Right, right. Well, it explains, too, I mean, what you're saying, because a lot of, and I think I, you know, made in the point in the bullet points, too, is that I think a lot of these experiences happen to athletes, particularly at the more elite level. I believe it's one of the reasons why they're able to be
right
at elite levels, because those states, maybe you would say stages, can be accessed more readily. And with all the, you know, the physical and emotional abilities too. But
right.
I tend to believe it. But without the context, you know, it is seen as, well, this is just how it is. You know,
right.
I was actually talking to my daughter, who was a rugby player at UMass Amherst, a few days ago about this, and just talking about the difference when you go into a sport and you're in the game. You know, and asking her if she gotten into these kind of experiences where things have slowed down and
right.
you can really see what's going on. And she said, yeah, that's just kind of pretty much what happens, you
right.
know. But in terms of contrasting that or having any context at all other than this is what the experience is,
right.
Is pretty much lacking.
Well, and that's one of your bullet points as well, which I'll go ahead and read now. A large enough framework or conception of sport, more than
meets the eye.
The eye, yes. Does not exist to explain or make sense of these experiences for athletes themselves and people watching. Looking at this from the four quadrant perspectives, this deeper view of sport does not exist in the lower left, so it is virtually impossible for it to exist in the upper left. The lower left being the actual interior values of a group or a
right, the a cultural values, if you will.
Right. Right. So if there's no way to talk about it in the group, there's virtually no way for an individual to recognize it in themselves.
Right.
And that's the upper left. So the fact that there isn't a good context for this discussed in the locker room, discussed mm-hmm. in the actual sport training itself, then individuals going through this just don't have any way to talk about it.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so you say, in other words, there is no language except for the zone or he was playing out of his mind, or a conception of sport or the athletic experience having this deeper reality so athletes don't recognize it or think it is normal, just a part of the experience articulated in any contextual way.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's one of the extraordinarily important areas, untapped areas for sport, and for at least two reasons, all driven from the fact that this transcendental experience in sports helps drive transcendental transformation
yes.
in structures yes. and in everyday experiences.
Right.
And one is for spirituality itself, that
mm-hmm.
sports practitioners, even if they are at red and just barely moving to amber, individual moving to team, they're still going through highly spiritual states. They're going through causal and non-dual states.
Right.
And these take an enormous amount of training in meditation to get individuals into, and yet it's something that elite athletes are going through all the time.
Right.
And I agree with you entirely that that's a large measure the reason they are elite.
Well, and also the mode of practice. I mean, I think that if you look at what athletes do, and I've, you know, never been in a spiritual community to know, but I would imagine if you're meditating for 8 hours a day or 16 hours a day,
yeah.
and you're practicing as a football player in the NFL, believe me, there's repetition,
right.
and you're doing the same thing over and over and over again. And
right.
And this is, you know, what is one of the things that Erin, my daughter, said in playing rugby. She said, well, you know, you do it enough, so after a while, the mechanics become automatic.
Right.
And so you can kind of easily get into these, if you will, you know, broader states or
right.
more comprehensive states
right.
In your sport.
And so that demands a contextualization, you know, first because it does deal with spiritual transcendence.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can have a whole new language if necessary, it's not necessary to use old religious language to find
right.
this. Much of that religious language comes from the magic and mythic levels and
mm-hmm.
really not appropriate for modern and postmodern times.
Yeah, where we are in the
history
of things, yeah, for sure.
But in addition to spiritual transcendence, there's a social transcendence. There's an actual impact on conscience and on how I see the world, and because there's an increase in states of consciousness, it, as I said earlier, leaves stretch marks over your structures of consciousness. It actually exerts a pressure on them to transform.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, in both of those areas, sports is not known for that.
No, absolutely. No.
The
even context is very different. right.
Well, I mean, out of their league was an expose of how they aren't that, and was just really devastating at the time.
You are listening to www.interlinking.com.